Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm so delighted to be sitting across from Steph Cha, who I met a couple of years ago at the LA Times Festival of Books. And she is the author of the Juniper Song crime trilogy. And she's an editor and critic whose work has appeared in the LA Times, USA Today, and the LA Review of Books. She lives in LA with her husband and two basset hounds. And her latest book is Your House Will Pay. Welcome, Steph. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so I'm so happy to get you here. Your new novel is remarkable.
Thank you. I like to hear that.
And I was hoping you could tell the audience how the idea came to you, because I know that this is a crime novel that's based on a true crime.
Yeah. I based it on the murder of Latasha Harlins, which was a 1991 murder of a 15-year-old black girl by a Korean shopkeeper in South Central Los Angeles. And when I was a kid in the early 90s when this happened, so I didn't have any awareness of what was going on. You know, I was also in the suburbs. And I only came to know about this history of Los Angeles as an adult, really. Right. And when I heard about this particular killing, I had a really strong reaction to it, both of anger and grief, but also of shame and guilt by association, because even though I didn't know the killer, she was Korean, and there's something about that that I felt personally. Mm-hmm. And looking farther into that murder, you know, so the Sun Jae-ju, the killer, actually ended up serving no jail time, and it was this
– right.
It was this massive fuck up of the justice system where she was convicted of voluntary manslaughter, but the judge kind of overruled the jury and didn't give the recommended sentence. And so learning about that story, and also learning that the killer was still in the county, LA County, and specifically, I think at the time I saw that she was living in the San Fernando Valley, where I grew up, I just felt this sense that we are from the same place and we probably right. know some of the same people, and we're part of this community that that produced this person. And I wanted to explore that that feeling of guilt by association. And I also wanted to look at the people who were left behind by this crime on the other side, the victim's family. And so I kind of started spinning this story that was about the family members of the principal characters of the 1991 crime. And the book kind of went from there.
Yeah. I mean, so in the book, the girl who's murdered is named Ava Matthews. And you can really feel that one act of violence kind of ricocheting through the lives of so many different people who you might not consider at first, even.
Yeah. I mean, and I wanted to look at that too, because, you know, I come from a background of writing PI novels, and those books are the structure of a traditional mystery is you kind of look at a crime and you follow the crime through, through one linear story, but you don't get to really linger with the people who are directly affected in the same way. Mm. And so I wanted to write a story where you really lived in that and you thought about the people who would be side characters in a more straightforward mystery novel. And because I find them interesting and
Right.
And, you know, I think maybe after spending so much time writing mysteries, I started thinking about, you know, the impact of violence in a really like on the ground way.
Mm-hmm.
And the book kind of came out of that too.
And I love that you switch back and forth both in time from the 90s to present day, and then also between these two families.
Yeah. I didn't want to write a novel that was a 90s novel. I wanted to write a contemporary novel, but I thought it was important to show at least a little bit of the background of how these people became who they are, And the 90s stories, I mean, those are all from Sean's point of view, the younger brother of the victim. And, you know, I wanted to kind of look at those, just a few select moments from that time period, and look at how it tied directly to present-day America, present-day Los Angeles, but also present-day America, where a lot of the same, a lot of the same concerns are still very much alive. And I think having those two timelines really allowed me to make that direct connection.
Yeah. I mean, I too was a child during the early 90s. And I remember knowing about Rodney King, but I still think I was sheltered from it in some ways. Like I certainly didn't watch the footage of his beating. And it seems like today it's worse that we haven't learned anything as a country or a society or as a government.
Yeah, what was shocking to me about, you know, because I was the same. Like, I knew about the Rodney King beating, I knew about the trial, I knew about the uprising, but only in this kind of vague background way. And so I only really started doing deep dive research once I started this project, and reading the specifics of the Rodney King case, you know, it was both really illuminating, and I see why it became this major flashpoint in 1991 and 1992. But I was also reading about this story at the same time that in the news, there was Michael Brown.
Right.
There was Freddie Gray, Stephon Clark, you know, all these black children and men being killed.
Unarmed.
And by police. And I was thinking, like, comparing those cases to the Rodney King case, if Rodney King were beaten in the same way today, I don't think it would break the news, because he was fleeing arrest.
Right.
You know, the beating happened at the end of a long car chase.
Right.
And he was running from the cops, and then he resisted arrest. And then he didn't die.
Right.
He survived. Right. He survived this encounter with the cops.
Terrible beating. Yeah.
And how often do you hear about the people who resisted arrest and survived a violent encounter with the cops? I mean, I'm just thinking of all of the names of dead people I know.
Dead people.
But I can't think of any off the top of my head who survived their encounters. So I think Rodney King, that only blew up because there was video, and at the time video was scarce.
Right.
But today, this incident that lit the entire city of Los Angeles on fire, I don't think it would even really register, certainly not on a national scale.
I hadn't considered the list of names that are in the book of Claudia Rankine's poetry.
The ever-growing.
Ever-growing list.
Yet
that doesn't contain people who've just been terribly beaten.
No. And I mean, I feel like the videos that have gone viral of inappropriate police behavior usually involve teenagers, like young people.
Yes.
You know, and those will get some attention. But I don't think those names really stay in the news cycle. And they have this absolute, like, oh, these are just kids thing, whereas Rodney King was a grown man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an ex-felon, and he was resisting arrest. So it's just a different kind of story. It's hard to know how prevalent that kind of police violence was at the time. I think the safe assumption is that it was happening a lot.
Yeah.
And it's just, and
there was
people
no video.
Just weren't seeing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, nowadays you just see all these incidents.
Right.
And it's both alarming and desensitizing.
Yes.
Because they pop up in your social media timeline.
Yeah.
Without warning.
Often. And I think it's so shocking that the idea that we have to have these perfect victims, mm-hmm. quote unquote, And that they have to be presented a certain way and to really get the right media coverage for them, they have to have been this, this, and this and not running from the cops or mm-hmm. not. And I don't think that hasn't changed at all.
No, and this is one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book, the idea of the blameless victim. Because, you know, when I started writing it, I think it was shortly after Michael Brown's murder, and the New York Times ran this really tone-deaf
yes.
piece that talked about how he was no angel.
Right.
And it kind of dug up dirt on this dead kid.
I mean, and I remember the photo choices were.
Yeah. And it's just like gross. And,
yeah.
you know, it shouldn't matter what non-capital offenses like a dead teenager
right.
might have committed that may or may not have even had anything to do with the arrest or the incident
right.
leading up to the death. And yet they keep getting trotted out because I feel like I often see the family member in a press conference talking about how this kid was such a good kid.
Right.
He was going to go to college. You know, he was such a good son. And like, I totally, totally, totally understand why a victim's
yes.
parents would go on the news and talk about their child in that way. I'm also aware that that gets a lot of coverage
mm-hmm.
and that shapes the narrative of this victim being more worthy of mourning and more deserving of justice than some other hypothetical victim who may not have like been some high achieving person, you know, but who cares? And you know, that's like a debate that I kind of set up in the book too. You know?
Yes, you did. You have a writer, this man who's covered the death of Ava as a true crime narrative. And one of the things that he does is constantly mention her classical music training.
Yeah. And you know, you mostly see that character, the white male journalist, through Sean's eyes.
Yes.
And Sean doesn't like him.
Like, no.
And that's like, and Sean is pretty clear about that. And I don't see that character as villainous in the same way that like Sean does. But I see what his role is in this whole,
sure.
in this whole production. And, you know, Sean also has differing viewpoints with his aunt who raised both him and his sister. And, you know, his Aunt Sheila is somebody who I actually based on a real person. She's the only person in the book, actually, who is based,
mm.
who has personality based on a real person. Because Latasha Harlan's his aunt, Denise Harlan's, she did a lot to keep Latasha's memory alive.
Right.
And she was the one who was constantly calling the media. She was the one who was making sure that on the anniversaries of her death, there was some kind of remembrance.
Right.
I think a lot of the reason why Latasha's memory is alive is due to the hard work of this aunt who became an activist after her niece's death and who became active in talking about like the deaths of Black children and in children's issues. And she passed away almost a year ago. But she's somebody who I admired a lot. And she and Sean don't see eye to eye on everything.
Right.
And she's somebody who sees the value in pushing that story.
Right.
Because there is value. There is literal.
She's working within the system.
Yeah.
To...
You know, and she and this journalist have a longstanding friendship, a mutually beneficial relationship that has some affection in it. And she's just kind of bought in, whereas Sean just wants privacy and
yes.
he wants to have his sister remembered as the person she was, not as this sort of mythologized Black victim. And I sympathize with both sides of that.
Of course. And I think you are so good at being generous to both sides in that in the story, I feel, you know, I feel for Sean and his aunt. And then I also feel for Grace, who is the daughter of the woman who has shot Ava kind of reinvented herself in her life. And I love Grace gets to be sheltered. Mm-hmm. And she gets to keep her head down a little bit.
Yeah, until she doesn't.
Until she doesn't.
And that's one of the things that I really wanted to dive into is this idea of political involvement or the personalized political being a choice.
Yes.
Because for a lot of people, it isn't. Yes. Or again, it is until it isn't. And, you know, Grace is a 27-year-old Korean-American girl. She's second generation. She is similar to, you know, versions of myself when I was younger and friends of mine and people I went to church with.
Right.
And people I just see in K-Town or Korean Valley. You know, she's somebody who hasn't really, like, lived anywhere farther from where she grew up than, like, Irvine.
Right.
And she still lives at home as many young kids of immigrants do.
Right.
When they're unmarried and, you know, just to save money. So she lives at home and because it's convenient too, because she also works in her family's store.
Right.
And so her world is very small and contained, and she's also busy. She works as a pharmacist, so she's on her feet a lot, and she's just occupied. And she kind of pays vague attention to what's going on in the outside world, but it doesn't really touch her in a visceral way at all until present day events kind of force this past history on her, and she learns for the first time that her mother was guilty of this act. And, you know, Grace is a character that I have a lot of sympathy for. She's also very frustrating, you know, in the way that somebody who is trying to, like, get educated very quickly on something that everybody else has already known can be frustrating. But she is somebody who I think is trying to engage in an honest and responsible way, at least, with what her mother has done and what that means for her family and also for the larger world. You know, and she's kind of frantic about it and stupid about it, but, I do have some sympathy for her. You know, it kind of, explodes her life and makes her reevaluate her relationship with her mother, which had always been very good and very loving.
Yeah. And then there's also more of an explanation for why her sister is so opposite her in so many ways.
Yeah, her sister Miriam, who's the older sister, she was, first of all, she was alive at the time of the shooting, whereas Grace was not.
Right.
But she also, you know, she's somebody who left LA for college and who kind of came back and, like, became a writer. You know, I mean, the two sisters, like, I'm somewhere in between them, mm-hmm. you know, like, and they're both, and they're both kind of annoying. So they're both, like, you know, they're both annoying and sympathetic in their own ways.
Yes.
Which is probably how I feel about myself. And yeah, I think, like, Miriam is the version that started paying attention. And she also learned of her family history just by absorbing like the history of Los Angeles, you know,
right.
She came across this. So she has already known about the family history for a few years and it's caused a rift. So she hasn't spoken to her mother in 2 years and Grace is trying to figure out why in the beginning of the book. And then she learns. But you know, I wanted to set up this contrast so that like Grace was kind of the protected innocent. And Miriam was somebody who'd like kind of been through this already.
And Miriam is like, an extreme version of the woke lady.
Yeah. And she's, and you know, again, that's like through her sister's point of view and her sister finds all of this like very annoying.
Right.
But yeah, she's, you know, and she's somebody that like, I think like I would be friends with. But like she, you know, she certainly has the, qualities of somebody who is like, you know, kind of social media. She's probably on Twitter a lot, complaining about stuff. Which,
when your version of the Proud Boys, what did you call them? The Western Boys.
I should have just called them the Proud Boys. Who gives a shit?
When they walk into the bar.
I didn't want to do a bunch of research into the Proud Boys.
Yeah, so
I
fuck them.
Twisted them a tiny bit.
Yeah, but Miriam would be the person to be like, I can't fucking believe these guys are here and I'm going to do something about it, which is like – heroic and also very privileged.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think, and you know, I think she's both aware of that and like can't really do much about it.
No.
You know, and I think she's in the position that a lot of us are in, which is like, if you're a person with privilege and you care a lot about these issues, you're going to look ridiculous some of the time.
Yeah.
If you put yourself out there. And I think like, you just have to accept and be okay with the fact that you're like, you're a little bit ridiculous. And that's fine. That's fine. You know,
like, so much better than the alternative.
Exactly. I think that's correct. Like, I think you can kind of not put yourself out there, or you can put yourself out there. And when you're out there, like, you know, like marching with your impervious body, that's a statement. It's also, yeah, it's also just like a little bit like easy to make fun of.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
That's okay. You know, you deal with so many stereotypes in this book. And as a nice Jewish girl who is mouthy a lot on Twitter, I saw a lot in myself in Miriam, who is a nice Asian girl.
Yeah, no, totally. You know, and I like Miriam. But, you know, it's hard to get away from that.
It's hard to get away from that. And of course, the character of Ava does not have that chance to be even stereotyped in such a way.
No, like she's, you know, Ava is somebody who I tried to make as alive as possible in the like instances that you see her.
Yeah.
But like ultimately, she doesn't have a chance to like have her voice heard even in this book. You know, you only see her alive a couple times through the eyes of her younger brother. And, you know, that's just one of the constraints. And you can't hear from the dead person. That's, you know, unless you're writing the book where you do hear from the dead person.
Right,
that's just
right,
not
right.
My book.
Right.
But yeah, like, and Miriam, you hear through through Grace's point of view. But you get more of her like opinions than you would of somebody who just isn't there to like even express them.
And Miriam has gone a little farther, even just in understanding that there are no easy answers here. There's nothing that she can personally do.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that she and her sister discuss is, you know, this idea of, what do you do when someone that you love does something terrible or is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Miriam openly believes that her mother is just a terrible person.
Right.
And I, as the author, just also kind of think that their mother is a terrible person.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. No, I think she's a terrible person. But I think you can be a terrible person and a good mother.
Yes.
You know, you can be a terrible good person and a good friend to some people, you know, and I think this is something that Miriam knows, like, because Grace kind of holds her accountable for like turning her back on their mother because she's never been anything but a great mother.
Right.
But like, what do you do when somebody who literally like sacrificed their life to like make yours better? What do you do when to other people, that person is, you know, a racist and a killer?
Yeah.
Like that. I was really interested in that question because I don't think there is a perfect answer.
No.
Because what Miriam has done is she has completely turned her back on her mother in this like way that felt clean to her, but that is really like inhumane. And and Grace's initial instinct is just to kind of, you know, is kind of totally tribal to like protect her mother. And I think there's something that about, you know, if you have to like contort yourself to defend a loved one, you contort yourself and you stay contorted.
Right.
And so there's no like getting out of that clean.
No.
And I was very like fascinated with that tension. Like this thing is not your fault and in some ways doesn't have to do with you, But you still
but
have
it
to,
has everything to
yeah,
do with
you. Yeah, but you still have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's like foundational, and how you decide to approach it, you know, will probably dictate like the person you are for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I just found that kind of decision point of interest.
Absolutely. I don't want to spoil too much of it. Yeah. So I feel like I'm going to start shutting my mouth a little bit. I do love that you bring up Camille Cosby in the book as kind of a really good example of that.
Yeah, because I remember when the Bill Cosby stuff started coming out, and she said something really terrible that, I mean, she basically suggested that like 100, however many women
right.
ended up accusing her husband were lying. And on the one hand, yeah, maybe it was purely conniving and she knows that they're not lying. But on the other, like, they've been married for 50 years. And I think there is something almost admirable about that kind of loyalty. You know, and I don't know the story of the Cosbys. Like, this is – like,
right.
they could hate each other and this could all be purely instrumental. But it could be about money, you know. But, like, there is something about this idea that, like, your duty of loyalty to your loved ones is so much higher than your duty of loyalty to the rest of the world.
Yes.
And at some point, the balance shifts in the direction of, like, yeah, you got to turn your back on your husband of 50 years. But, like – It's a pretty high threshold, I would say. I'd almost say like if somebody said my husband did something really bad, and it seemed out of character to me, I would almost have to like see the body before I believed it.
100%. And I think so many, especially women, are having these reckonings quite a bit now.
Yeah, and I see it a lot, like stories of women defending men who have clearly done wrong.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of piling on, and I totally understand why that happens, and I am sympathetic to that too. But I'm also sympathetic to the knee-jerk response of, this is somebody I thought I knew and that I care about a lot, and my natural inclination is to not abandon them.
Yeah, you have to reevaluate your entire life and every belief you've ever had.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot to ask.
You know, and I think it's stupid when, like, I don't know, Lena Dunham comes out and, like, defends a guy who, like, you know, probably raped somebody.
Right.
But, like, it's so stupid that you wonder what was in it for her, and it just seems like probably what was in it for her was like she thought this friend of hers needed defending because he clearly didn't do it.
Right.
You know, like, and so I see something human in that impulse to defend, even if it ends up doing a lot of harm.
Yes.
Which it often does.
Yes.
Because, you know, calling a bunch of women who have been assaulted liars, that's extremely harmful.
It's not great.
So,
Well, I love the book. I will allow listeners they should read it rather than just listen to us talk about it, because it is excellent. What have you been reading lately, Steph?
I actually just opened up Kevin Wilson's new book, Nothing to See Here. We share an editor and he gave me a copy. You know, I actually just read The Joy Luck Club.
For the first time?
I read it when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
But I decided to reread it.
How did it hold up?
I loved it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I kind of wondered if I would still, you know, I don't know. I guess when I was a kid, I wasn't approaching it as like a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as like an adult Asian American female writer, I both feel indebted to Amy Tan, and I'm like impressed with what she did. The book feels pretty modern. I'm trying to think of what else has been excellent.
How about crime?
Crime?
Yeah.
Well, I just did an event with Angie Kim.
Oh yeah.
I loved Miracle Creek. I thought that was so good. Elizabeth Little has a book coming out in February called Pretty as a Picture. That is excellent.
Great. Good to know.
Ivy Pacoda has a new one coming out next year too.
I
haven't read it yet, but I'm a big fan of hers. Also a friend. Attica Locke, Heaven, My Home. That book is mind blowing. Bluebird, Bluebird, which is the first in that Highway 59 series. That won the best novel Edgar 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. And I would say the second one is even better. I
think it's a good endorsement.
It's a totally beautiful, powerful novel. I was completely stunned by that book. I've read some Michael Connelly lately, and I always enjoy him.
I like that.
And he's also been like very supportive of this book. So
that's great.
It's a real mensch.
Well, Steph, thank you so much for coming on here.
Yeah, thank you so much for hosting me. This has been great.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.